On this episode of Still Loading, we are riders on a mission. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I am your host, Josh Koval. This week's episode is going to be a little bit different. Not necessarily different in regards to the format, but indifferent in how it connects to video games. Today on the show, I got to interview Andy McElfresh. Andy was one of the lead writers and developers for one of my favorite cartoons growing up, Rocket Power. And while Andy did not work directly on any of the Rocket Power video games, he had a large part in creating the show we know and love today. It was an absolute pleasure to get to speak to him about his career, and I think you will all really like this episode. Now, with that said, I will do an episode at some point on the Rocket Power games, but until then, here's my interview with Andy McElfresh. Today on the show, I am extremely excited, and I use extremely for a very particular reason, because today on the show, I have a writer, I have a special effects coordinator, I don't know what your specific title was on Yoga Hosers, but a writer who's worked on so many different things, and the reason I have him on today is because he was a writer and lead developer on a show I watched a lot as a kid, and there's a couple games made about it. So, and I don't know if he has worked on these games or not. We'll find out when I ask. But today on the show, I have Andy McElfresh on. Andy, how are you doing tonight?
Good, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining me. I am a huge fan of yours. Mainly, I was telling you off mic, I listened to your podcast, Edumacation, that you do with Kevin Smith. And since learning about you from there, I kind of looked more into your work. You were also a writer on the Jay Leno show. That was the Tonight Show, right?
Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
And then you also were one of the writers on White Chicks, as well as the show that the Wayans brothers had before that, correct?
I worked on the Keenan Ivory Wayans late night talk show.
That's what it was.
The Scary Movies, but I was a late hire, so I don't have a writing credit. And then I wrote the first couple of drafts of White Chicks with Marlon and Sean.
That's incredible. I just thought it was just so interesting to hear that, because you going from Jay Leno, or starting at that and then moving over to Jay Leno, they just seem like kind of different worlds. But now you tell me it was a talk show, that makes a lot more sense. That you wrote for that show and then you moved over to Jay Leno later on.
Yeah, I mean, I have a weird career. I've written movies and TV shows and done reality, and I just did that doctor show last summer with Ann Curry, the Chasing the Cure. And I mean, I've just done all sorts of weird stuff, but it's just because I have a lot of interests and people seem to like working with me. So I'll just keep going. Ooh, I've got a show that just came out on HBO Max called Full Bloom.
I remember you tweeting about that. You said it was kind of like the Great British Baking Show, but for flowers.
Yes, it is. But there's no British people. Well, there's one British person, and he is the florist to the House of Windsor. So we got a very special.
So is that like royalty, the House of Windsor?
Yeah, like the Queen and her.
Okay, I know so little about the royals; it's not even funny.
It's no problem.
But that you actually brought up a couple points that were actually part of my first questions. One of the things you said is that you have such a varied career. You've worked on a lot of different things and you've worn a lot of different hats. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is that Rocket Power specifically was so different from a lot of your other writing credits. Besides Jay Leno and, like I said, Jay Leno, White Chicks, and the Keenan Ivory Wayans talk show, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started my career as a food writer. There's a restaurant guide called the Zagat Survey. It used to be a little book, and I was their first employee. I was designed the books and wrote lots of food reviews, and I got to learn a lot of stuff, which is what I enjoy in my work. If I get to learn stuff, then I'm very happy. I also had just graduated from college, so I was a swimmer in college, all through college, and I weighed 158 pounds.
God, I wish I weighed that still.
And then 8 months later, after working as a food writer, I weighed 203 pounds.
So, I could see the temptation and why that would happen.
So it's not like I went to the fancy restaurants when La Bernardin opened in the Hyatt, New York. It was like one of the most important restaurant openings in the U.S. in the last 50 years. Zagat and his friends went. But when like Stick to Your Ribs Barbecue or every Thai noodle house, or we were running a pizza survey for the New York Times, I went. And I just got fat.
I mean, you ate good food, but that good food took its toll.
I also ate terrible food. Like I got food poisoning my first year probably 8 times.
Ooh.
It was the only thing keeping me from becoming 250 pounds was all that vomiting.
That's a weird thing to bank on. Like, I eat all these unhealthy foods, but I hope that one of these will just give me food poisoning so I can just lose all the weight I just gained.
Oh, it was awful.
Oh, no.
But I did have we used to have friends over. I had a refrigerator full of tinfoil swans, which if you're not familiar, at leftovers at a restaurant, they often will wrap, in New York, they'll wrap them up as a little tinfoil swan.
Huh.
We'd take them out and we'd heat them up and, have a delicious walk through some of the more excellent foods that we've had recently with friends. It was nice.
That's cool. I didn't know they do that. I don't get to go out and I live in such a suburban area, so I don't really get to make it up to New York very often at all. So you got into your writing career through food, through Zagat. How did you transition that over to, I guess, Hollywood, for lack of a better term, for working in the industry?
Well, I mean, I wanted to be a TV writer or a movie writer or both. And when I got the job at Zagat, because his brother-in-law was starting his own ad agency. And a friend of mine from 2 years before had worked as a copywriter at an ad agency and found that that was easier to transition to working in television.
Okay.
But the brother-in-law did not have his... I was going to have to take another job in Philly. The brother-in-law did not have his payroll together. And so Zagat's like, why don't you work for me until he's ready? And then once it was time, Zagat was like, you can't go. I can't let you go. So I stayed there for a while, but I got to hire some folks, and some of the nice young people I hired left Zagat to go across the street in Columbus Circle to work at MTV. And so a friend of mine, Anastasia Pappas, who's a wonderful friend, she was working. She did a show for MTV called the Top 20 Video Countdown. And she would have these famous guests and they'd be on to promote their stuff. And her second guest she had on was Kelsey Grammer, and he was promoting the show Frasier, which was just starting.
Oh, wow. That's definitely putting in a time and place too for all the listeners.
Yeah. So he wanted to do the show like Frasier, but the writers on Frasier were like, we're not going to write that for you. So he asked her if she had anybody that could write a funny script in the character of Frasier. And she called me because she's like, you're funny, but your dad was a shrink, so you must know something about this stuff. And so I wrote the script. And, she said, this is MTV, so always go a little too far and we'll dial it back. When I give him the script, he'll know that you've gone too far and we can just dial it back. And so I put in stuff like, there was a Nine Inch Nails intro. And he's like, Nine Inch Nails. They remind me of when I was a kid feeling the sting of my father's belt. Like all this craziness. And he did it word for word. We faxed it to him. A fax machine is short for facsimile, and you feed paper into it and it makes a copy on another machine. And I don't know how old you are, so I have to make
sure. I know what a fax machine is. I use one at my job.
I was just kidding. And he faxed back just a love letter to her saying, let's do it. So I got to go to that taping and meet him. And, one of her boss was like, hey, what else can you write? I was like, anything? So I freelanced there for about 6 months. And then I quit Zagat, but freelanced for Zagat. And then I went full time at MTV to start their home shopping network.
Okay.
We did the Beavis and Butthead Mega Model Jam, the Rolling Stones Voodoo Lounge Tour, the Naughty Gear from Naughty by Nature, did a bunch of shows, And then they brought me into the sort of marketing part of MTV and said, we do these specialty locations like the MTV Beach House and Mount MTV, you know, the Winter Lodge and Spring Break. Would you be interested in kind of writing, because you've done these sales things for us, writing stuff for that? So I partnered with Michael Bloom, and he and I were partners for a long time. He and I did Rocket Power together and so on. And we did the MTV Beach House in Malibu. We did 2 years of that. And that was partly because we got to do really anything we wanted and do crazy stuff. One of the VJs got sick, the guy that would do the menus, and menus on TV are what was like, coming up next.
And
then at 3:30, he got sick. So Michael just picked up a big tiki mask we had hanging on the wall. He would dance around. He rolled his pants up so you couldn't see. He just saw legs. And he danced around. And I did the voice. And we did like 2,000 of them in the first summer. I was the mighty tiki god. And I would make a reference to, I would say, you might remember me as, and then something from, you know, retro TV, because Viacom had just started Nick at Night.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, like Joni Loves Chachi and stuff like that were airing. So I would make references like, you remember me as Chachi from Joni Loves Chachi, whatever. And then, so I got to be on an episode of Baywatch. That's where I'm getting to. It was the most exciting moment of my life so far. I was the Mighty Beach House Tiki God on an episode of Baywatch. And I still get checks for 6 cents.
The royalties still come in for Baywatch.
Yeah, pouring in. Let me tell you, it's cost more to cash the check than the check is worth.
That
evidently there's a bar in the valley somewhere that if you bring in one of these pittance residual checks, they give you a free beer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, how often do you visit that bar then?
Well, I've never been there, but I've got.
Well, that made it sound like a really like that joke. It wasn't meant to be a joke at your expense. I just realized how that could have been taken.
I just didn't even feel like it was at my expense. I've got enough stuck to my bulletin board, though, that it could be a pretty wild night.
You should when you get close to the end of, or when you get ready to retire or something, I don't know how many years in advance you're thinking of that, but you should just get them all and just have a big rager there.
Yeah, that's pretty fun. So that was how I kind of transitioned over. It took a while, and I wrote a bunch of different stuff. I wrote a lot of the day parts, and then I got hired, and they ended up making me the head writer for all of production. So I wrote a lot of specials and a lot of the shows that we produced there. But that was back when the channel used to show videos.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was easier to monetize shows that were full half hours, like The Real World and Road Rules and shows like that. So, you know, the writing was on the wall that the stuff that I was working on in my department was going to definitely not be there forever. So my partner and I just kind of moved on. After the second beach house in Malibu, we wrote some spec scripts and sold them out here. And that's how we moved to LA.
So then what kind of drew you into working on Rocket Power? Because like I was saying before, it seems very different from everything else that you've worked on in your career. So what kind of encouraged you to try your hand at a kid show? Was it just something that was offered to you, or did you seek it out?
It was a weird, again, like, you always have to pay attention to all the things you've done in your career as arrows in the quiver. And so I was at the Keenan Ivory Wayans show, late night talk show. And I got a call from the studio that did Rocket Power, Klasky Chupo. They were pitching McDonald's. McDonald's had never done any animated shows based on their characters. They were very reluctant to make that big change.
Yeah.
And I had done a bunch of stuff with McDonald's at MTV, at the Beach House and Spring Break. So they knew me already in their marketing department. And they said, maybe you could talk to this guy and see if he could help us, you know, stay on brand, but also do these videos. So I came in and pitched The Wacky Adventures of Ronald McDonald. The first one was called Scared Silly. Available on VHS, and that was a big success for them. It was the biggest selling video that year because they sold them in McDonald's.
Oh wow! Okay,
it wasn't the highest grossing, but it was the most sales because I think it went for like $650 or something. It was an inexpensive video at the time.
Yeah.
And if you want the special deluxe edition with the hologram Ronald McDonald on front, let me know. I can hook you up. So once we finished with that and it was a success, Nickelodeon was in business with Klasky doing Rugrats. They also had another show called The Wild Thornberries.
Mm-hmm.
And they had done other things like Cat Dog and just a few other shows with them. So they came to them and said, you know, Nick came to them, and Nickelodeon was part of the Viacom family. So we were on their radar from having executives that had gone from MTV to Nick.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just, they said, we have a show that we just have a title and we don't have the characters and we don't know what it's about. We just know that we want this extreme sports, kids that do extreme sports.
Okay. It'd
be a great marketing opportunity. And so they asked me and Michael to come in and pitch it. And we just pitched stories from when we were growing up as, you know, in South Jersey doing, you know, surfing and skimboarding and water skiing and all those sports, but we updated the sports, but we kept the stories the same.
Okay. So
that's why if you watch Rocket Power, you will hear them use expressions like shoobies, which you, since you're from the Philadelphia area, you might be familiar. That's a very East Coast, South Jersey term.
Yeah.
And it means people that just are there for the day. They're like kooks, you know, they're city folk who just come to the beach for the day.
Yeah. And yeah.
A lot of people think this comes from the shoes that they wear, but it's actually back in the day, they had a railroad line that went from Philadelphia and then it went down the coast of South Jersey to the Atlantic City, and you could stop off and get off at anywhere from Wildwood to Avalon and wherever. And they would give you, as part of your ticket, it was a return, a round trip, and you would get a shoebox with a lunch in it. And so they called those people shoobies. And so that's how Michael and I got in there, and we lucked out extremely because when we signed, they started making the Rugrats movie, and they'd not made a movie there before, and Nickelodeon had never made a movie. And so all of our executives were all focused on that, and we would pitch ideas and write scripts, and they'd be like, yeah, that's fine. So we got to do what we wanted. It was great. It's a really great experience. And the people at Klasky are super, super talented. And, you know, Jim Duffy was our lead director, and he's like a legend. He did just so many big shows. Like, he did the G.I. Joe cartoon. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I'm 31. I was a little bit too young for G.I. Joe, but I pretty much a lot of the most popular 80s cartoons, I have at least watched an episode here and there. Yeah. So I know what you're talking about.
So he famously, they were making the show and the voice actors sounded very flat. It was a big action show. And so they all show up one day and he's put in treadmills into the recording booth.
Really?
The actors had to act while running on a treadmill, and it made the show great. And he was like, you've never gotten good work out of people faster than by telling them that they have to run on a treadmill while they're doing it. They love him, and so much so that if you look at the voice credits on that show, Snake Eyes is Jim Duffy. And of course, Snake Eyes is a character that never spoke.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that funny?
That is really funny. That's crazy. And I just looked him up. I had no idea how much stuff he had done. I do see, unfortunately, he passed away in 2012.
Yeah. He was up there in years.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't look after himself too well, but he was a really great guy.
He did Captain Planet as well.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like, I'm technically an 80s baby because I was born in 89, but I'm really just a 90s kid.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, that's all before I was like 10 years old. So it's like, it's a very different memory from there, from once I got into junior high. But like, a lot of the cartoons that these, like, I was a huge Rugrats fan, gigantic Rugrats fan. So I would always remember how do you say Klasky? Is it Zupo?
Chupo.
Chupo. Okay. Klasky Chupo. I would always remember their banner that would show up before all their cartoons, because they did so many things that I ended up watching or paying attention to. It's crazy to see how much of them he did. And once again, that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, just because Rocket Power was a huge thing for me. It was right when I got into extreme sports, even though I can't do any of them. I can't skateboard. I played hockey, so that's the closest that I got to them. But I lived vicariously through Otto and Reggie and Twister and all that.
Squid. Don't forget about Sam.
One of my favorite things that I didn't notice as a kid is your little joke for his last name.
Dullard.
Yeah. And the fact that he's kind of like the more tame one out of all of them, and he's the dullard. I thought that was, as a kid, you know, that went right over my head. But I was rewatching some episodes in preparation for this, and I like a lot of the little jokes that you throw in there that go over kids' heads. That's one of my favorite things, rewatching old kids' cartoons and movies, seeing those slight little nods for the adults in the room that have to begrudgingly watch their kids' cartoons.
Well, there's some funny stuff in there. The Sam, actually, the character design, if you were to see me now on a Zoom, you would see me as having it's gray hair, but very light hair. Big black glasses and perpetual tan lines because I ride a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so they gave all those characteristics to Sam. I thought that was funny. Originally, Sam was from New York. We wanted to have the kid be very street smart, but not very good at sports. And so he would, you know, was going to bring a different vibe to them. And the Nickelodeon said, well, we prefer that he was somebody really from a place that doesn't have any sports like this, and that's why he didn't do it. And so while we were getting all of our scripts and everything accepted and all of our ideas, they loved the design guys were getting tired of redesigning the characters over and over again. And so originally his shirt said NY.
Okay.
And they were like, can you make him from Nebraska? And I was like, all right. And they just erased the Y and stretched the N out over him, so they didn't have to do that much work.
The entire month of December here on Still Loading has been sponsored by Geek Guilt. Geek Guilt is the online store for all of your geeky needs, from clothing to costumes to home living to the video games themselves. Geek Guilt is worth checking out. And right now they have a special on mod mics. Mod mics are microphones that you can stick to your headphones using the patented magnetic clasp system, which is safe for metal, plastic, wood, and other materials. And it won't leave any damage or residue. I personally find this convenient because you don't have to go out and buy another gaming headset if yours breaks. Get a different pair of headphones and pop your mod mic back on. There are three different models of mod mics: the Mod Mic Uni, which uses your standard 3.5mm plug, the Mod Mic USB, and the Mod Mic Wireless. If you buy a pair of headphones and a mod mic, you will save 15% off on both of them. Go to geekguilt.com and check out everything they have to offer. That is geekguilt.com. On top of all that, Geek Guilt has been nice enough to sponsor a giveaway here on Still Loading. If you go to my Instagram page, at Still Loading Pod on Instagram, you will see a post for this giveaway. If you like that post, give me a follow and tag a friend in the comments. You will be entered to win your own Mod Mic Wireless and a pair of DT770 Pro headphones. This giveaway will end at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday, December 14th, 2020. Once again, that is 11:59 p.m. Eastern on Monday, December 14th, 2020. So make sure to hop on over to my Instagram and enter. So one of the other questions I had for you with this is, what type of research did you have to do for writing this show? Was there, you said you drew a lot of these stories from your childhood, yours and Michael Bloom's childhood, but did you have to do any other research on top of that into these extreme sports that maybe you weren't as familiar with?
Sure, we did a ton. We met through MTV when we did the Beach House. We met all the world-class surfers and a lot of people at Surfer Magazine, and a lot of the, you know, very, very high-end X Games guys like BMXers and skateboarding, obviously, like Tony Hawk. So we met all these guys, and we decided that we would make a mandate with Nickelodeon that, you know, until then, like surfing in a cartoon, they're just on an ironing board on top of the wave. Like there's no physics. And we're like, we want to make the sports look real. And so they actually hired this really great board artist who was able to churn the stuff out really fast, so that, because normally that kind of boarding, you kind of send away for it. You just ask, like, you know, the filing company in Korea, they would do a lot of that work.
Okay.
We wanted it under our control. So, and so we did snowboarding and all that stuff. And we just literally just called people like Surfer Magazine. We had them all up and we're like, here's what we're doing. You know, we bought them lunch and everybody sat around the table and told us the things that they, I've always bothered them about, you know, animated shows and extreme sports and what we needed to focus on. And then we would send them stills and animatics, and they really helped us a lot. And I think there's an authenticity to the show that people don't really think about now. But mm-hmm. then people were like, this is crazy. Those kids are surfing. Like, how crazy is that?
I actually just watched the episode where Otto tries to ride a big wave. I mean, it's in the first season, but where the rhino comes to town and mm-hmm. he is riding that gigantic wave during pretty much a tsunami. And Otto tries to go and do it. And of course, you know, he wrecks and gets in a lot of trouble with Raimundo. But it just thinking about that, like you're saying, it's crazy. These kids are surfing. And I just remember watching all the stuff they would do. I'm like, how are these 10-year-olds doing all this? I mean, it's, or I don't know how old were they? Were
you
they
know, 10? Between 9 and 13 is, depends on the episode in terms of how they act. Cause we were kind of basing them on those years in our lives.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's like, it's the first, what really is important. It's like that first time when you have freedom as a kid, when you're, mom and dad say, you can take your bike. Like, we're not mm-hmm. going to be with you. And you do it, and you're as responsible as you can be until you're not. And then you,
yeah.
that's when the stories happen. So
the one thing I was going to say as well is you were talking about the realism in it. And it was funny. I was watching it yesterday, and my wife was in the room, and she was watching it. And it was the episode where Sam and Twister are, or Maurice, Sam and Maurice are doing the lifeguard and training, or becoming lifeguards and trainees. And the one thing she come, because my wife was a swimming instructor and a lifeguard, and she was saying everything they were doing is surprisingly accurate for a kid's show. Like, that's what they would do if someone was actually drowning. And knowing what I know about you with edumacation, it was like, I wonder if that was an Andy McKelfish touch, like something where it was that realism is something you wanted to incorporate.
Well, Michael and I were both lifeguards, and we both taught swimming lessons. And
I forgot you're a swimmer. You mentioned that earlier.
So it was definitely, that one came from us. But, you know, in Southern California, there's a big tradition of junior lifeguarding. Mm-hmm. So those were all drills and things. And we have friends that were lifeguards, you know, that did that stuff. And we were lucky. We got, I think that character was played by Arlie Ermey.
Yes, I looked that up.
Yeah, he's the guy that was in Full Metal Jacket as the drill sergeant. He's mm-hmm. a real life drill sergeant. And he did our show. He was the nicest guy. We had so much fun that day as he did his voice.
I've heard good stories about him where he's just down for like anything.
Yeah. So that came out good. Now, realism, it can only be taken to a certain point in a cartoon. Like, you know, at like the board artists, the joke is that they're board artists and they get bored too easily. I mean, you literally are, think about it this way, like they have to think frame by frame. Oof. And so to keep themselves amused, they do some crazy stuff. Like on Rugrats, the standards people had a devil of a time keeping them from having shots of the baby bottle. The kid would put the baby bottle down, and then there would be a shot where the bottle's in the background and the kid is in the foreground, and the bottle is now a condom stretched over the bottle and not just the nipple. And they're like, that is not good. And like, we had one episode, the secret spot episode, where, you know, the local guys that get all mean to them, they put some, you know, they put some tattoos on that one guy that you can't show on TV. but in like, I think it's like one of the first episodes to air, like maybe the third or fourth episode, Otto is in a competition at Madtown, mm-hmm. and everyone's focused. Like we watched the whole thing. I went from boards to animatic to, you know, there's a step in between to getting the full color stuff back and sitting mm-hmm. in the edit. And we shipped it. And for the first year, nobody noticed that during the competition, in the background, the ship from Star Trek IV comes down, a tractor beam comes out, and it picks a whale up out of the ocean.
You know what? I don't know. I feel like I remembered that too as a kid. Did it air though? Or was that just, is that just,
oh, it totally aired. It aired for a year before anyone was like, hey, people are saying that there was some sort of Star Trek IV reference. And so we're like thinking, looking at the scripts, like, what are they talking about? I don't think so. I mean, we are big fans of Star Trek, but and then it just turns out that one of the board artists put it in and it stayed. It was pretty funny.
Now, did they have to remove it later on due to copyright stuff or?
No.
Oh, thank God. So we could go and watch it now.
Yeah, it's parody. You can totally leave it in. So they did shit like that all the time. We would put in lines like, there's one episode where the kids they're going to have a big lobster boil and they're trying to catch lobsters and there's a big storm and they end up, you know, there's all sorts of, they think it's sort of based on like a film noir murder mystery style thing where kids get, you know, they amp up the scares because of the storm. And at the end, Officer Shirley enjoys dinner with them because Officer Shirley kind of finds everybody and brings them all back to the shore shack.
Yeah.
And she turns to Ray and said, Ray, get the butter, which is a line from Last Tango in Paris, which is a really filthy line. And from that point on, because the actors were like, that is hilarious. We know what that's from. They, whenever the actor that played Ray and the actress that played Officer Shirley were together, they would make it like they were having a secret affair together. And so that's people were like, hey, show's going great. Are Officer Shirley and Ray like getting it on? What's going on with that?
So in the episode where I watched it last night, I thought the same thing. Actually, I was watching the episode where they were playing street hockey in the middle of the night, and Officer Shirley finds them because they're going to meet Lars to basically show up, like, keep their rep, and she drops them off and. The back and forth that she has with Ray, I was like, are they fucking, something going on here?
Yep.
I knew it. I it's weird because, you know, once again, goes over your head as a kid, but rewatching it as an adult, I'm like, there's something there. So that's kind of funny.
There's certainly something there. So you mentioned Lars.
Yes.
So Lars, we wanted to be our nemesis character, and so we needed him a lot. And we wanted to make him an older brother because we had a brother-sister relationship that was fraught with, you know, Otto and Reggie, but they loved each other. But we wanted a mean older brother that was also, you know, somebody that would remind you of, like, the Kiefer Sutherland character in Stand By Me. It was sort of that paradigm for him. And so, you know, Twister, it was important to Nick that they be a Latinx family, a family from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so we gave them all names. We gave them the most popular names of children in Mexico at the time. So Pedro, Jose, just a bunch of names. We wanted it to be authentic. And Nickelodeon came back and they're like, that's just way too much. Can you change their names? So a friend of ours who is an old friend, he plays the voice of the yacht club owner. He's just a funny guy. That's a friend of ours. His family is all from Denmark. And so we made them all their names of Twister's family are the names of these guys from Denmark. So it's Lars. Like, what kid from Mexico have you ever heard of?
Yeah.
And Maurice and Philip and Kim and Dog. So that was a funny thing. And also naming wise, Tito. We named him Tito because we'd always, you know, every television show has a Hawaiian episode. They go to Hawaii.
Yeah.
And we wanted him to be from a big family in Hawaii. And so Tito's family is Michael, Jermaine, Tito. They're all the names of Jackson 5.
Jackson 5. Yeah. That's so clever. That's funny. I was thinking when I was watching it, like, just how diverse though the show was. Cause, you know, being a kid in the 90s, I do remember a lot of the cartoons I watched. It was pretty much just a lot of white people.
Yeah.
But the fact that you would have a Latinx family, Officer Shirley was black, Tito was Hawaiian. Like, it was just this big group of different cultures. And I, like, Otto and Reggie, I always felt like they were, like, maybe it's just because they live out in California, so they're more tan, but they seem to have like a slightly darker complexion. I don't know if that was an allusion to a race thing or just like, or they were, or
that was the, that was the designer wanting, he's like, the mom is dead, so she could be any ethnicity. And so he made them a little, make their skin a little darker to reflect.
Oh.
And, but you know, in Southern California, like a lot of people are like, that's kind of a neighborhood, like in Huntington Beach or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are family, very diverse cul-de-sacs everywhere with people from everywhere. So that just fit. It wasn't like something where we're like, okay, we're going to team Benetton this and get everything in there that we can. We just were like, let's do it so that it's natural and it actually plays a part in the show and isn't just there for window dressing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like that. One of my other favorite characters, I haven't been able to see much of him recently, but are the Stimpletons.
Merv and Violet.
And Merv is such a lovable, angry curmudgeon of a man.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like just listening, just watching how angry he gets over the smallest things. It makes me laugh so hard. Was his character inspiration that you created, or was it based off of someone you know?
Well, there's a few, like a lot of the lines that he has, by the way, played by the beautiful soul, Henry Gibson, who was on Laugh-In. He's just the nicest man. He's passed away since, but that was another love fest we had. And then Edie McClurg played his wife, and she's a big character actress. You've seen her in a million things.
Okay.
But he, like, my wife's dad would always, he was very loving and not a mean, a grumpy person, but he would always give out with these lines like he was. So we'd always say, like, Joanna's mom would say, like, well, we're going to have to get going, Leo, or we're going to be late for the whatever. And he'd say, keep your shirt on, woman. And that's where Merv got a lot of his lines.
Oh, that's so funny.
Obviously, there's nothing worse for a bunch of kids that want to play street hockey than having a grumpy neighbor that is shitting them all the time. I shouldn't swear on this podcast.
No, you can swear. It's fine. It shows it in the second episode where Reggie's in charge of watching, or maybe it's not the second episode. I think it's in the, I don't remember. It's in the first couple episodes. I don't know if it's segment A or B. For which one, but where Reggie has to watch their pool and then they end up draining it and they can go skateboarding, and then they flood. Twister doesn't put it all in. He's supposed to put the hose into the storm drain and it doesn't. It goes into the Rocket's basement. So when they suck all the water back, it ends up with all of their stuff in the middle of the pool.
Yeah.
I don't know. I enjoyed the show a lot as a kid, and it was funny because my neighbors were into the extreme sports, so it was my way to kind of connect with them.
Awesome.
But anyway, so what we've kind of talked a lot about it, but I want to know if there's any other parts of the writing process that you haven't been able to talk about. Like, what was the writing process like for Rocket Power? Like, what's it like in a writing room for a kid's cartoon?
You know, the way we staffed it was we had some animation writers from that had worked at Klasky that were very good. And we hired some young people because you always have to do that on the staff to make sure that you know, the next generation can learn from the stuff you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do, basically we would come in and break some stories in the writer's room together. So it would be like people would pitch ideas for stories and then we'd work with them. And then Michael and I would go off on our own and say, let's remember when this reminds me of this, or remember we talked about this, and we would come up with the storyline. And remember, it's not like the most important thing in the story is what happens with the characters, not so much the plot and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then we'd find the good overlays for the plot, like, oh, well, you know, taking their freedom too far, we'll use that story idea in this one where they go very far afield and scare people because they can't be found, sort of thing. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then we would go back and sit with the writers and talk, and we'd assign them. And so usually the person that pitched any part of it would get to write the first draft of the script.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michael and I would rewrite it, and then we would read it to each other in the, you know, the writers, we'd all get together and read it. We didn't do it for every episode because once we got, you know, these were 11-minute episodes. So, you know, there's 40 of them in a season. So we got to know, like, oh, this one's solid. We don't have to do a read through. Let's do it with the actors and then let their performances find you know, the way we tweak that line or make the run shorter or whatever. One important thing is for an 11-minute episode, you have to be able to say what you have to say very quickly. And so you have to really craft it so that people are speaking to each other in ways that are realistic, but also that drive the story fast and hard. So that became, you know, and it's something you see like with a lot of young, like when I started out, you know, my first movie spec I wrote was 206 pages. Kevin Smith wrote a, you know, 390 page script once. I mean, you know, and then you learn that's not what a movie is. That's not what a TV show is.
Yeah.
You know, it's one reason I got hired on The Tonight Show is that I did an ad parody script as part of my sketch pack. It was one page. You know, a page is roughly 30 seconds to a minute, and it was one page long. And the head writer's like, everybody hands in 5-page ad parodies. There's no 5-minute ads. So that was one of the things I learned at Rocket Power was how to be more efficient and find a rhythm that you could get your story told really quickly.
And that makes a lot of sense to me, especially my boss at my job always says brevity is the soul of wit.
Yes.
And so I feel like that definitely makes sense, especially for a kid's cartoon. And as someone who tends to over explain and allow or and speak in a lot of it's very superfluous. I just use way too much language to get to a point that I'm trying to say. So I need to work on that. So it makes sense because you only have 11 minutes, like you were saying. And I even think back to like Looney Tunes cartoons where they're what, seven or eight a piece or something like that.
They're a little shorter actually, but some aren't that long, but that's a different kind of writing. In fact, yes. We went to Comic-Con when our show debuted and they put us on a panel with guys that did more classic animated shows. And there was a big argument. They're like, we don't board our show and then write the script, which is how a lot of shows are done. Like everything from the Flintstones to, you know, a lot of shows, it's a visual medium. They start with the boards and they come up with sight gags. And then they go back and say, okay, what story can we make out of this? We're like, for us, the most important stories are ones that we can't just find in a board. They're ones that we want to tell about our own lives. So we did it a sort of an opposite way. There were a lot of opposite things about Rocket Power. We did not use adults to play children, which most cartoons like The Simpsons, you know, it's Bart is played by, and, you know, I mean, all the kid characters are played by adults and, you know, Bart's played by a woman and that's always been the way it's been. So that's why, like in season 3, when Michael and I had left, we were like, we're going to have to cast new kids because these kids are growing up, man. Twister sounds, his voice is deeper than mine. And they kept them. So now the Twister's like, third season is like, come on, guys, let's get it back to the, and it's like, what are you doing? But that's, you know, it's fraught having a, that's why people don't use kids, so that you can make 5 trillion episodes. But yeah, we used physics. We had a lot of research on the show. It was kind of an odd thing. Man, the guy from the Flintstones hated our guts. I was like, what are you doing?
Really?
Can't we all get along? He was that angry about it? He was super angry.
Well, it's not like he's working on it. That's kind of strange. Yeah, that reminds me of I've talked about it before on the show, and this kind of ties it in with video games. But there's during the PS2 era of gaming, there was two of the biggest developers, Insomniac and Naughty Dog, had two very different philosophies of designing their games, and the way you kind of described your writing style or the producing style for Rocket Power versus more traditional animation, it kind of reminded me of that, where Naughty Dog, what they do is they would design a space and then design a purpose for the game within that space. Mm-hmm. So what happens sometimes is that you'll be running down a hallway and there might be a room that has no purpose at all because they designed the space first and then input the purpose for that space afterwards, versus Insomniac with their games, they would design the purpose first, which kind of sounds similar to what you did with Rocket Power, where they designed a purpose first and they're like, all right, how can we build a space that would best suit this purpose or best suit this design choice?
Sometimes though we did pick a space and right around it, like there's an episode where they go down the California Incline, which is an actual place in Santa Monica. but it really was to drive the story that every single kid does that hill before they're ready and they're in over their head and it's terrifying. So we were able to, you know, sometimes it went hand in hand, but mostly we did start from story.
To kind of, because we are getting close to the time that you said, so I have a couple more questions for you.
Sure.
One question is, I was looking up some of the games from Rocket Power. That the whole reason I had you on to talk about Rocket Power, because there are video games, like I said, based off the show. Mm-hmm. And the one game I'm looking at is called Rocket Power Beach Bandit. It said the writing staff was from Klasky Chupo, but did you work on the, did you provide any insight on the game? So, and if not, that's fine, but I just figured I'd ask it. So
no, I did not. We were the game. You got to realize how this animation stuff works. You finish all of your boards, you have the record done, you edit the radio play version of it. Then you, marry all that to a animatic, which is basically a lot of stills with some animated elements in it that move very jerkily, but give you an idea of what the action is.
Yeah.
And you send it to Korea, and a company in Korea sends it back in a year. And they send you back. So you get the color back, and basically you go through and you accept shots, and there's certain shots that you, our show, we did a lot. We accepted most stuff because we did a really good job ahead of time getting the boards right.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to have stuff redone, but you can edit with shots that are temps, and you edit. And I mean, so the time frames are really long. You know, it's the opposite of the Tonight Show, where you write a joke in the morning and it's on TV that night. This is something where, so by the time the show is actually on air, we're long gone. Like, we were off doing what were we doing when the show started airing?
It would have been in 1999, in August of 99 is when it first started.
Yeah, I think in 99 we were doing we were at Fox TV Studios doing some reality show. But that was a cool job only for the fact that our offices were in Nakatomi Plaza from
Dyer. What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I forgot that was the Fox building that's from.
Yeah.
Or that Die Hard is from takes our place. Office, and I can't speak.
Our suite mate was the nice lady that produced Fight Club. And Chris Columbus and his team moved in for 5 weeks of pre-production on the first Harry Potter movie.
Oh, wow.
So we had brushes with greatness there, but the weirdest one was you'd show up at the lobby after lunch or whatever, and the Secret Service would hold everybody downstairs because Ronald Reagan's office was on the top floor, and he never went.
What?
He was already senile at that point, but he would come in once in a while, and nobody was allowed in any of the elevators while former President Reagan was in transit.
Yeah.
So that's what we were doing when, the video games were being made and that kind of stuff. So,
no, the like I said, the only reason I was curious is because it mentioned that like the Klasky Chupo team wrote it. So I wasn't sure how much of that was involved. Like, how were you part of that team? And I'm kind of glad to hear that it wasn't, because the plot of the one game is that some villain steals all the sand off of their beach.
This is stupid.
I know. And so I wasn't going to say anything if it was you, but I'm happy to hear it wasn't, because it was just like this. It was a very comical, over the top villain who is basically like this big guy from I don't even know if this was in the show, but the CEO of a company called Golem Industries. And he steals all the sand off the beach. And I didn't get to the end of the understanding the story. It was very strange and very bizarre. But anyway,
I just want to slap somebody right now. I get the golem. Okay, the golem is from traditional Jewish mythology or mysticism, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Folktale of the sort of automaton person that, you know, it's something that you create to do your dirty work, and he's made of sand.
Oh, and actually there's a lot of robots in the that you fight in the game. So that kind of plays into that automaton thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not very well.
Sorry, but if I seem cranky, I sprained my eye rolling it just now. When you
It's a kind of ridiculous plot. Just reading it off of Wikipedia quick, the gang is just about to start their summer vacation when they realize all of the sand in Ocean Shores has been taken away by a mysterious criminal. After investigation, they find out a company called Golem Industries has stolen all the sand, and the gang decides to go about stopping them. I don't know why he decides to do it. It's a very strange plot. Well, not good also, plot.
Kids start their summer vacation. The kids are always doing stuff all the time.
Yeah. Are they ever in school throughout the course of the show?
There was when they catch the Fiji flu, they have to stay home from school.
Oh, that throws me. I forgot about that episode. I was trying to rewatch as many as I can, but there is a good chunk, so it's kind of hard.
We made 80 of them. But Dr. Frymuth in that episode, that was the name of my doctor when I was a little kid. And we got the guy that played the dad on the Waltons to play him.
Okay.
So we had a lot of fun with that show. Definitely, definitely.
Just some last quick questions, then. Who was one of your favorite voice actors that ended up working on the show? Or maybe a voice actor that you were surprised that did a voice on the show?
I mean, it's hard to say. We had a lot of people come through. Lee Ermey was great. Dale Dye, who is also... Mm-hmm. A former military person, and he is an actor, and he played, I mean, you've seen him in every military movie that's ever been out.
Either advising or in it.
Yeah. He's great. He was the script consultant for Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just one of those guys that you got to warm him up a little bit, and then you just press play on a story and he just tells you a great story. So that was fun. We had, what are their names? The two women from The Simpsons that do the Rugrats voices. They were on our show and a couple of things.
Rugrats. I'm E.G. Daly, I know, did Tommy.
Well, anyway, I guess I can't claim that it was a special moment when I can't even recall the actress's name. but yeah, we had a lot of great people through there. What's funny, there was a kid. We wanted to cast a kid because... we were expanding our kid roles, and we had this one character, Mackenzie, who was this little girl who would always like punch people, and she was really
she gets angry with her sandcastle's getting destroyed.
Yeah, and so she was, we had to cast somebody that was good for that, and that was a really fun role. And then we wanted Eddie, the Prince of the Netherworld. I don't remember that character, but
yes, I do.
It's like this crazy goth kid, and so. Once in a while, we had a lot of stage moms there because these kids are all kid actors. They were all in like the Little Rascals movie.
And oh, wow.
So, we were talking to the kids and they're like, oh, we've got this kid that could play him, but he's a little weird. We're like, that's perfect. That's exactly what we want. And by the weird, what they meant was that he's just at 10 years old was the most like industry player you've ever met in your life. This kid comes in, he's got his hair slicked back. He's wearing a suit and tie. And he walks into the record. And Michael and I, at that point, our voice director had gotten sick. And so we voice directed a bunch of the episodes. And he knows full well who we are because we just introduced ourselves outside of the recordings booth.
Yeah.
And he comes in and he says, it was an episode that we'd written. He goes, hey, before we get started, I just want to know who wrote this stuff because this is some smart stuff here. Really class A material. And we're like, you do not have to kiss ass that hard, kid. Just play the role. And then he was Eddie the Prince of the Netherworld. So we get out, after he's done, we go out to, make sure, say thanks to the kids and watch all the stage moms steal all of the snacks. And his dad shows up and his dad is dressed identically to him. Hair combed exactly the same way, like same tie, same everything. And he says, he looks us in the eye, he gives us that whole Dale Carnegie thing. He looks us in the eye and shakes our hands very vigorously and says, hey, I want to know who wrote that stuff. That's some smart stuff.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. It was weird. Like, that's a like, weird thing to happen.
That feels like something out of like a Macaulay Culkin movie, like when he was a kid, obviously.
I don't think there's a lot of Macaulay Culkin movies now.
So you don't really have to make a good story. So my last question for you before we wrap up is, how did you go from that to working with Jay Leno on The Tonight Show?
Well, I mean, you know, part of my career has been, you know, I told you about the McDonaldland videos. Mm-hmm. We worked with American Airlines at MTV, and they wanted to do something with The Tonight Show. And a friend of mine had been hired on The Tonight Show that I'd worked with in late night on The Kenan Show. And he was the director on the Kenan Ivory Wayans show, but he wanted to be a writer on this show. And so his reel had a lot of sketches on it that I had written. And so they gave me a call and I came in and I made the American Airlines for the summer of 2001. We shot 20 of these little things that came after the monologue, and they were kind of like an ad, but they were more like a Tonight Show sketch. They're really funny. Like Gilbert Gottfried as the annoying passenger, and rip his seat out and throw it out the window at 30,000 feet and just like crazy stuff. We had a really fun summer, but our last shoot date was September 11th, 2001.
Oh,
when an American Airlines was like, we had an accident. We're going dark for a year. We're going to give all of our ad space to United Way. And it was really just an unbelievably like weird thing. Like obviously it was the worst day in our history.
Yeah.
Super sad, but also I had to go and, you know, pay off the production company and all the employees and stuff. And after that, you know, Jay and the head writer were like, well, you're going to come work for us, right? That's how we started. But yeah, it was a weird, weird time.
That what a crazy way to get a job. I mean, they
didn't hire me anyway. They just wanted to have me on the other payroll until I was finished.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where I met Kevin Smith.
Yes, I've heard a lot of the stories of how you guys met on Edumacation.
Yeah. None of them are true, but yep.
Okay, so actually, I forgot one last question. This is something, a segment that I started with one of my interviews, and I have forgotten to bring back for many of them. My wife famously is not really into video games and not really into a lot of the stuff that I am. So I always like to ask her, like, do you have a question just off the top of your head that may or may not have anything to do with who I'm interviewing? So she asks, so this is questions from Courtney. Okay. And she asks, do you prefer stripes or polka dots?
Well, you know, horizontal stripes are a risk for me. I told you about the weight gain during the first job. And
yes.
But, you know, I have a polka dot tie that my wife got me. And every time I wear it, somebody asks me, how come you're not wearing the big red shoes? So I think I'm going to have to go with stripes, but they have to be vertical stripes.
That you answered the follow up. If it was stripes, I was going to ask horizontal or vertical. And if it was polka dots, what size of dots? So we have your answer. Andy McElfrish definitely says vertical stripes. So yes. Adjust your wardrobes accordingly. But okay, that will do it for this episode of the Still Loading Podcast. Andy, seriously, thank you so much for joining me on this episode.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Where can the good people find you on social media? And then after that, is there anything you'd like to promote?
Let's see, at EdumacationAndy on Twitter. And then I'm on Instagram. I've been getting into birding lately. I've gotten a lot of beautiful bird photos, if that interests you at all. And I also post funny stuff on there. And that's MT Verbal.
And then as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. You can also email me, StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. You can go to Patreon and go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod and consider donating. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. Probably more helpful though would to give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. It helps more people find the show and helps spread awareness about it, so please consider doing that. And finally, the most important plug/shout out I have is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care in hospitals. So you can go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating.
Wow, what a great charity. Now I feel guilty about plugging That's Kevin Smith Club, so you can listen to my podcast.
No, you shouldn't feel bad. I haven't been able to donate much to the Bit by Bit Foundation, so I do my best by just trying to share it as much as I can on here. So, right. But no, Andy, thank you so much for doing this. This has really been like This may be a little bit too, like, I'm fluffing you up a little bit too much, but like your podcast, like Kevin was one of the reasons I got into podcasting, and I found you through him. So like, this is really awesome to get to speak to you.
Well, I'm so happy you invited me. It was great meeting you.
And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading, and I will see you all next time.